Dr. Scott and see the presentation. Our luncheon speaker is from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He spoke last year at our conference in Williston, if he looks familiar to you. He is an energy specialist, and he's been appointed to the Economic Advisory Board of the United States Council on Competitiveness, a group made up of the CEOs of the Fortune 100, top university presidents, and presidents of three major unions. He's been interviewed on many national television shows. He's an economics emeritus professor in his hometown, but he talks a lot about the Bakken and how it sits in the world, because we're just a piece of the puzzle for petroleum internationally. So would you please welcome again Dr. Lauren Scott.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you. Well, how y'all are? It's a good old South Louisiana greeting. Glad to be here. I'm so glad that Delta got me here in time. I was really worried about that at one point, but it's great to be back in North Dakota. This is about like my fourth or fifth trip here, and it's already always great to be here among, what are we doing? Are we getting louder? Are we loud enough now? Can you hear okay? Anyway, good to be here. I was had an interesting experience. I was getting ready about what announcement about 3 days ago in my house. I've mentioned at one time to you about my wife. My wife's a very successful businesswoman, just retired from being the executive VP of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Louisiana. Tough gal. I was in front of my sink getting ready for the trip, and she was over there in her sink, and I was looking in the mirror, and I said, Peggy, I mean, look what I'm seeing here. I mean, my hair is turning gray. It's starting to fall out. It's like God put his hand down on top of my head and blew out my hair through my nose and ears. And I got wrinkles, my butt sagging. I said, tell me something positive so I'll be ready for this trip. She said, well, your eyesight's dang near perfect. Really nice lady about that. It's tough. We were in San Francisco one time. We're walking through a park, and there was this couple. We passed this couple on this bench. I mean, they were making out like crazy. I mean, they were really making out heavy. And Peggy looked at me and said, why don't you do that? I said, Peggy, I don't even know that woman. Don't ask me to do that. Well, I hope I'm able to communicate. I want to be able to communicate with you and be able to communicate with you very truthfully. I don't want to try to pull any wool over your eyes. I'm going to tell you one last story before we get started that involves air flight. I was a little worried about getting here. There was a lot of rain in Minneapolis where I had to fly in from this morning. There was these two men who were stuck in O'Hare, and they were at the bar waiting for their flight to finally be released. And this very attractive woman sat down next to him. They started chatting her up. And after a while, she looked at one of the guys and said, look, let me ask you a question. Said, how old are you? He said, well, I'm 60. She said, man, you look good for 60. He said, well, thank you very much. After a bit, her plane gets called. She leaves, and his buddy looks at him and says, why did you tell her you were 60? You're only 50 years old. He says, because I don't look good for 50. Okay? Well, there's a sense in which I'm a little surprised I got invited back. And let me tell you why. I have just finished writing the first draft, the Louisiana Economic Outlook, which we always do in the last part of August and the first part of September. And because we are barely the number two state in the nation in oil production and the number two state in the nation in natural gas production, I use that barely advisedly because I'm not sure from day to day whether y'all passed us up or not. That's how big your output has been. But because we are an energy state, I have to do oil and gas forecast, price forecast. So what I'm going to do is share with you what my oil price forecast was 1 year ago today. This is a picture of the price of Louisiana sweet by year from 1980 through our forecast for 2015 and 2016. At the time, the price of oil was around $100 a barrel. Remember those days? And we were taking a very conservative position. We said it was going to drop to $95 and then $90 a barrel in the next 2 years. We missed on that, okay? Now, I taught forecasting at LSU for 30 plus years, MBAs and executive MBAs. And I want to talk to you all about science for just a moment. When I taught forecasting to those students, I told them that this is the second most difficult thing in the economy to forecast. And the reason for that is 2/3 of the oil production in the world is under the land of countries where the government's running the oil company. And you never know what they're going to do next. And that's precisely what happened. I'm going to argue with you in just a moment. Now, if I were to tell this group, if I was to tell this group, that I could forecast the price of oil 30 years into the future, plus or minus $2 a barrel, you would probably send me packing right now. You know, because, I mean, look at that thing. Matter of fact, let me ask you this. From a strictly scientific standpoint, what do you think is more difficult to forecast, this or this? I mean, which one is the most difficult? Is this more difficult than this? It's obvious. This is food consumption in the United States. I mean, you can forecast this with a ruler, a piece of graph paper. You don't know what graph paper is? Graph paper, and you would miss plus or minus, you know, 1% or something. It's very easy to forecast. Isn't it obvious from a scientific standpoint that the more variable something is, the more difficult it is to forecast? Isn't that pretty obvious? Okay. This is the second most difficult thing in the economy to forecast. You want to take a wild guess on what's the first most difficult thing in the economy to forecast? The weather. Now, I want you to think about this from a scientific standpoint for just a minute. The idea that you can forecast the weather 30 years into the future, plus or minus 2 degrees of accuracy, I'm going to suggest to you is absurd. And when you build economic policies that just crater economic growth in this country around that notion that you can do that, I'm going to suggest to you that something's wildly, wildly wrong. Now, having said that, I think there is some evidence out there for global warming, and that is women's underwear. If you look at women's underwear, what is that? Personally, guys, exactly why we're against global warming is beyond me. I think this is one of the greatest moves in time. Now, what I want to do is I want to take you on a little trip here. And I'm going to try to explain my idea, my thoughts about why this sharp decline in oil prices took place. So I'm going to take you on a little trail here. You kind of stick with me. It's going to take us a few slides to get through this. But I'm going to make a major point, and it's going to have a lot to do with what we think is going to happen to oil prices going forward. And so we've got to start with the shale plays. Shale plays responsible for, look at this, U.S. oil production up 85% since 2008. There's no country in the world that's come even close to that kind of performance. The fracking thing changed the whole nature of this industry by a mile. And one of the major ways it changed it was this graph here. This is a very important chart to my argument here. If you look, and in 2008, not that long ago, 7 years ago, we were importing 66% of the crude oil we consume in this country. Today, we're importing 43%. The primary reason for that is look at U.S. oil production. 5.2, 9.4. Okay, remember that 9.4 number. We'll come back to that in just a minute. So we're producing a whole lot more oil, and as a result, look what happened to our imports. 9.8 down to 7.2, and there's one country that lost 2 million barrels of oil a day in sales in the United States. And that made them mad. That made them mad, as you'll see in just a minute. So this is an important chart. Remember this, because the loss of that 2 million barrels of oil per day in sales really matters here. Now, each one of the shale plays is really, really different. I was talking to some people yesterday in Chicago, and I was telling them about you guys up here and what's happened in the Bakken play. I mean, you go back to 2003, not that long ago, you're producing 10,000 barrels of oil per day, and now you're producing in excess of 1.2 million barrels of oil per day. You passed up Alaska about 2 years ago as the number three producer. You're about 100,000 barrels of oil a day away from passing Louisiana up as the number two producer of oil. Now, the thing about your play, though, is each one of these shale plays is really different. It's not like drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. You drill in the Gulf of Mexico, you're doing something to me that is more difficult than landing a person on the moon, technologically speaking. You're drilling down 2 miles deep before you hit the bottom of the Gulf. You go another 5 miles deep then. When you learn some new technique about drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, that technique is pretty easily transferable to West Africa, offshore West Africa, offshore Brazil, North Sea. That's not necessarily the case with shale plays. Here in the Bakken, you drill down and you hit pretty solid rock. You go across that rock horizontally for a couple of miles. You break that part up into little sections, right? Called a word that I just left. But anyway, break it up into sections, and then you explode. You actually create explosions down here in each one of these stages, and it creates cracks in the rock. Then you pump a lot of water, a lot of sand, a little bit of chemicals down there to keep those cracks open, and the oil and the natural gas come flowing out. That's what happens in the Bakken play. And that's one of the reasons you've been so very, very successful. For those who are Ole Miss graduates, this is a map of the Louisiana, the state of Louisiana. We have our own shale play. I didn't mean to offend anybody from Ole Miss. But anyway, we have our own shale play called the Tuscaloosa Marine Shale, running right here across the central part of the state. Now, when you drill down into this stuff, you don't hit rock. You hit clayey stuff. You go horizontally across that, create your units down here and explode holes, well, the cracks have a tendency to just close right back up. And it wasn't until about 2 years ago, an outfit called Gooders Resources finally broke the code and figured out how to do this. But the exact same techniques used up here didn't work down there, especially in the completion part, because it was clay stuff. Because of that, each one of these plays has a different break-even point. For example, you look in the Bakken play, and I'm going to say something about the age of these numbers in just a minute. The Bakken play, the break-even point may be $50 a barrel, whereas that Tuscaloosa Marine Shale is $92. A whole lot more expensive. Guess where the first rigs vanished when the price of oil dropped? It was in the Tuscaloosa Marine Shale. Tuscaloosa Marine Shale is dead right now. Now, let me tell you something important about this column of numbers. This column of numbers is probably 14 months old. What you will discover is that over time, all of these numbers have come down. And here's what, and they'll come down for a number of reasons, mainly because the people who operate in this industry are smart, clever, greedy capitalists. Just like y'all, you know. We're all capitalists, right? Did I mention to you the last time? Even ministers are capitalists. You ever heard of a minister that was called to a lower paying job? No, but we're all capitalists. And so what they've done is they figured out ways to make more money. And part of it's the fracking costs are down about 32% in the last year. Now, part of that is because all the oil companies have gone to Schlumberger, Baker Hughes, trucking company, I don't care who it is. And they said, look, guys, we're getting half what we got before. You're going to give us a 35% cut on what you've been charging us. So there's a lot of shoving down, or rolling down, stuff is rolling downhill, as it often does. And so all these costs are being shoved down. But in addition to that, you look at the time to drill. Anadarko was taking 18 days to drill a well. Now it's 7.5. EOG here in the Bakken, look, they dropped their drilling time to drill a well in a third. The completion cost for EOG has dropped from 10.5 to 8.2 million. And then in addition to that, they've got a whole lot more output per well. I mean, look at this. This is a startling picture here. Just look at this one on the left-hand side here. This is the Bakken play. Back in January of 07, 100 barrels of oil a day first year. That sucker's now up to 500 barrels of oil per day. So they're not only figuring out how to drill it faster, complete it faster, cheaper, but they've also figured out ways to get more oil out of the dadgum well, which is very, very good. So as a result, all of these numbers have been coming down over time. The country that lost the 2 million barrels a day in sales in the United States underestimated the cleverness of the people that operate in this industry. They totally underestimated this aspect of the thing. In addition to that, this is a great average. This number here for the Bakken is a great average. If you look at any play in the United States, let's play the Bakken here. There's a part of that, usually in the great middle part, where the well, the shale is not as deep, and when you hit that sucker, I mean, the oil just comes flowing up. But when you get out on the edges of the play, the wells have to be go deeper, and maybe the shale is not nearly as productive. And so I think, Mr. Hale, where are you? Gave me this information. You know, I think you provided me with this information. This is a really important piece of information here. If you look at these parts in the nice, new, fat middle, look at these break-even, but look over here. Look at the break-even point when you get out on the edges. And as a result, and this slide is again about 4 months old, When I looked at this, I think he had about 112 wells, and only six of them were outside of the green area. And so this is what is under attack by a country. The country is attacking the edges of all the shale plays because they know if we can shut down activity on the edges, we can shut down oil production in the United States, or at least we can cause it to start going down. Now, I'm not exaggerating this edges thing. This is very, very important. A lot of times people will try to exaggerate stuff. They do it on TV all the time. Like this guy here, last night a movie theater was robbed of $1,000. The thieves took one large bag of popcorn, a combo meal, and a box of Milk Duds. Okay? That was a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much, right? Now, the last time I was with you, I talked about this a little bit. But this is also a key to understanding why the price of oil fell, why it fell so fast. And that is the weird effect that your oil production had on oil prices. If you went back to 2007, prior to 2007, if I'd come up here to speak to you people, I would, of course, there was no you people at that time, right? You knew, you happened. But if I talked to you in 2007, I would have told you this. You go pick up the Wall Street Journal and you're gonna discover something. The price of oil is the same everywhere in the world. I don't care if it's West Texas Intermediate, Louisiana Sweet, Venezuelan crude, Mexican crude, North Sea crude. The price of oil is the same everywhere in the world, with a little difference because of the grade of the oil. And the reason for that is there are about 3,700 very large crude carriers floating around on the surface of the ocean, taking oil wherever they can get the highest price. And you remember from your principles of economics class, that that was a good one. You remember your principles of economics class, that has a tendency to keep the price the same everywhere until you people came along. And then when you people came along, here's what happened. You started producing all that oil up here in the Bakken play, and you had to get it down here where all the refineries were. And so you there's not a whole, we have enough miles of pipeline in Louisiana to circle the globe 4.5 times. You people don't have that. You have very little way. So you're getting it down here any way you could, trucks, mainly train, et cetera. And what you were doing is you were getting it down to about right in here someplace, if I've got my, right in here at a place called Cushing, Oklahoma, okay? And all that oil started stacking up in Cushing, Oklahoma because there wasn't enough pipeline capacity to get it all the way down here to the refineries. Well, you remember from principles of economics, what happens when you have a bottleneck, okay? Well, guess what happened? For the first time I've ever seen this happen before, the price of West Texas Intermediate dropped below the world price, sometimes as much as $20 a barrel. If you produce West Texas Intermediate, you do not like that. That is not a good plan. So it automatically starts you thinking, how can I fix this problem? And so what they did was they said, what we're going to do is we're going to take a pipeline called the Seaway Pipeline that runs stuff this way, and we're going to spend 18 months reversing it. And then we're going to build two or three other pipelines bringing this stuff down here. And when they built those pipelines, guess what happened? The bottleneck in Cushing, Oklahoma, by the way, Cushing, Oklahoma is where the price of West Texas Intermediate is set on the NYMEX. When that happened, well, guess what? The price of West Texas Intermediate and the price of Brent suddenly came together. You didn't have that difference anymore. Until all that stuff showed down up down on the coast at the refineries. And unfortunately, our refineries down there are mainly designed to refine heavy crude. Your crude is very, very light crude. And so, shoot, or as they say in Texas, oh, hell. Suddenly, we had another bottleneck, and guess what happens when you have a bottleneck? When you have a bottleneck, the price starts to break apart again. Suddenly, the West Texas Intermediate price was below the world price again. Which means smart, clever, greedy capitalists started thinking, how can I fix this problem? Okay, I don't like my oil selling for $20 less than everybody else. And so they thought, you know, here's a solution to this problem. Let's just export the stuff. We don't want, you know, just ship it on out to places that can refine light crude. And this is the key to the recent price decline, by the way. Now, the problem here is it's been illegal to export petroleum to the United States since about 1975. Now, there recently was a little bit of a give on this when the Congress allowed us to do a swap with Mexico. But this is not the same thing as exporting crude. That didn't solve the problem for us. However, did you, I don't know if you know this, it's all right, it's legal to export crude petroleum products. You can export all the gasoline, all the diesel you want. That's okay. As a matter of fact, I showed you folks this the last time. Beginning in 2011, we became a net exporter of products. We actually export more gasoline and diesel than we import into the United States. Which brings up the question for these smart people. What's a product? Do I have to spend $3 billion retrofitting a Marathon refinery so we can now handle sweet crude? Or could I spend about $500,000 on a little unit out in the middle of the Eagle Ford? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this little machine or this little refinery thing, and I'm going to take a barrel of oil, and I'm just going to skim off a little bit of the volatile gases off the top of the barrel of oil. Is the result a product? So last August, very important date, last August, a company went to the Department of Commerce, who rules on this, and said, is this a product? The Department of Commerce said, well, yeah. Then another company said, really? They went to the Department of Commerce and said, is this a product? And they said, yeah. Nobody even goes to the Department of Commerce anymore. Now, why have oil prices declined? And more importantly, why did they drop so quickly? I want to suggest to you it is not because of rising U.S. oil production per se. U.S. oil production in the United States went up like this. Prices did not go down like this. Prices went down like that. They dropped straight off a cliff. And when I see prices falling off a cliff like that, I always look to the Saudis. Now, why did the Saudis are behind this, and I'm going to explain to you why in just a second. Well, they tried to do the same thing they did back in the 80s. Now, you people weren't even producing that much oil in the 80s. Louisiana's producing a lot of oil. Texas producing a lot of oil in the 80s. We got creamed in the 80s. By the way, it's a little second, a little setback. Did you know the price of oil used to be the easiest thing in the economy to forecast? From 1950 to about 1972, it was the easiest thing in the economy to forecast. The price of oil varied between $2.50 and $3 a barrel for 2.5 decades. It's the easiest thing in the economy to forecast. And then a group of countries got together. There were 13 of them at the time. Now there's 12. They got together. They produced a lot of oil. And they said, you know what let's do? If we understand supply and demand, if we'll just take a little bit of oil off the market, reduce supply, the price will go up. So here's what we're going to do, gang. We're going to assign everybody a quota, okay? And we're going to form a group called OPEC. And at the top of this is going to be the Saudis. They have the most reserves. They get the biggest quota, okay? And what they did is they took oil off the market, and boy, did prices go up. They went from $3 a barrel to $35 a barrel at one point in 1981. More than 10-time increase. They said, this is really great. Now, the only problem with cartels, and you learned this in your principles of economics class, is that each individual member knows that if you cheat just a little bit on your quota, you make lots of money. And so what started happening in the early part of the 80s is Iran would produce 1,000 more barrels than they're supposed to. And the Saudis would say, oh, shoot, well, we got to keep the oil. So they would reduce their output by 1,000. And then Iraq would produce 1,000 more barrels. And the Saudis would say, oh, shoot, well, we reduce our output 1,000. We got to keep that oil off the market. Then Nigeria would produce 500 barrels more. The Saudis, can you see where after a while that'd give the Saudis make the Saudis mad? And so in 1981, the Saudis looked at the rest of the member nations and said, you want to see what cheating's all about? Watch this. They turned on the faucet, pumped a lot of oil in the market. The price of oil dropped from $35 a barrel to $10.50 in 6 months. Now, is that what's going on now? Oh, by the way, when that happened, guess what happened when they did that? When they went, they pumped all that oil in the market. All the hands went up. The other 12 member nations raised their hand and said, let's have a meeting now. Let's have an emergency meeting. We promise we will never cheat on our quotas again. So they had a meeting. They all agreed. They all moved back to their quotas, turned the faucet back. Price of oil started drifting back up again. That's not what's happening right now. Put yourself in the place of the Saudis for a moment. Look what has happened since 08. First of all, since 2008, they have lost 2 million barrels of oil a day in sales in the United States. So they lost a big chunk of the U.S. oil market. Then these companies, last August, went to the Department of Commerce and said, is this a product? Can we export it? They said, yes. And the Saudis said, hell no. You've already got a big chunk of the U.S. market. Now you're going to have the international market? I don't think so. They turned on the faucet, and the price of oil dropped like a rock. Now, one of the major constraints on the price of oil staying real low for a long time is, I promise you before God, every hand at OPEC is raised right now saying, for God's sake, let's have a meeting. Okay? This is not working. People in the United States, people working are too clever. They figured out more and more ways to get the price down, the break-even point down. It's not working. And if you're Venezuela, you are being killed right now. I mean, Venezuela relies on all that oil money for all their infrastructure, for the welfare programs, to keep their drilling program going. And they got less than half the oil money they had back a year ago. Now, they held out for a year, but I guarantee you right now, they're saying, we can't wait until December, the next meeting. We've got to stop this. We can't keep this up. And the same thing has happened in many of the other nations. Venezuela, I've mentioned Venezuela, but all the other member nations are saying, we can't keep doing this. Now, what they've been trying to do is to kill the edges, because they figure if we kill the edges, we're going to start reducing oil production in the United States. And in fact, oil production in the United States has already peaked and is starting to go down. And the primary reason is this picture right here, which I got from our friends in your minerals department. This is the typical Bakken well here. Now, this is the decline curve in a typical Bakken well. This is not, if you're drilling offshore Gulf of Mexico, let me tell you something. The decline curve is like this. You need a lot of output for a long time. 65% drop in the first year. Now, what this picture means, if you want total production to continue to grow in the United States, you got to keep drilling all the time, because you got to offset the steep decline curves and all those dadgum wells you got out there. And so, if you look at the Bakken play, this doesn't show up the Bakken play, but according to the EIA, I mean, the Bakken has started to lose production. I don't know if y'all's data are showing this or not yet. But the EIA is arguing that Bakken production peaked about a couple of months ago and is declining. The Eagle Ford is declining. The only place where it's kind of hanging in there right now is the Permian Basin, which is a totally different kind of shale play, by the way. It has like four or five different layers to it. It's really, really rich play. This is what the EIA is saying. This is the rig count. Pow! Look at that tremendous drop. Rig count dropped in half in the United States. Production continued to grow for a while, as it will. But here's what they say the July estimate is. They don't have all the data in, but they say that production has already declined in the United States. I was reading, I think it was Credit Suisse, that says, okay, it looks like we're going to end up about 9.2 this year, next year 8.8. I mean, given what's going on right now, the edges are being killed. In the Gulf of Mexico, the edge is the shallow waters, the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, wells are just stacked that typically operate in the shallow waters of the Gulf of Mexico. They're all stacked down there in the ports down in Louisiana. By August, oil production from shale areas will have fallen for the fourth month in a row, according to the EIA. Now, see here, y'all are familiar with this, but you know, you had the big drop in oil prices. And then you remember when it came back up to 60? And we all said, man. And then, oh, shoot, we thought it's a V, you know? Go down again. Unfortunately, it's a W, right? I mean, everything was okay until the second drop, when it went down to near 39. It's now back up to 44. It's coming back up. We're kind of in a W situation right now. But it was that last drop that was the killer, if you look across the oil and gas industry. The responses to this latest price decline, of course, the rig count really dropped. But look what BP has reduced spending from $26 billion to $20 billion. Shell laying off 6,500, reducing their capital budget by $7 billion. Chevron eliminating 1,500 jobs, cutting spending by $1 billion. ConocoPhillips cutting spending from $16.5 to $11 billion. Wood Mackenzie says oil companies have canceled or delayed $200 billion in projects since the mid-2014. The oil service companies are getting killed right now because there's less work with fewer rigs, plus the shoveling down thing is going on. They're being asked to do same amount of work for a whole lot less money. So that brings up the question of where is the price going now, which is, I know what you want to know, right? Well, let me kind of tell you how I have thought this through. I'm an economist, so when I think price, I think supply and demand. So I'm going to look at those two different factors and kind of tell you the way I'm kind of thinking about things at this point. Let's look at the demand side. Credit Suisse, they have an energy area that does a really good job, I think, at analyzing the energy market. And here's what they say is going to happen over the next 2 years. They say you're going to see an increase in consumption of petroleum, increase in demand for petroleum in 2016 to 2017 over what it is now. Most of that coming from the emerging nations, but also in the OECD, the developed nations, you're seeing some growth there as well. So they're expecting to see an increase in demand. Increase in demand tends to put upward pressure on price. But that's not the really tricky part of this. The real tricky part is what's going to happen on the supply side. On the supply side in the United States, we're already seeing the price, the production of oil going down. And it looks like it's going to continue to go down. We're not keeping up enough rigs given the decline curve in these shale plays. So I think it's just going to happen. Oil production in the United States is going to go down. That decline in production has a tendency to put upward pressure on price. You know, less supply, a little bit higher price. I think the other thing that's going to help us out here is OPEC. These hands are going up. The other 11 member nations of the OPEC cartel can't keep this up. And so they are saying, you know, we've got to let the price go back up some and just kind of deal with the results of that. Plus, you know, we have to have money to drill. We have to have money to produce oil. And right now, we don't have it. The only one of these 12 member nations that has enough money is the Saudis. And the Saudis started out this with about $790 billion in reserves. That's already down to about $450 because they're not only got half the price they had before and they had the same expenditures, but they've also been financing a lot of military activity to save their rears, okay? And so that little reserve is going down. They can't keep oil prices that low. So I think you're going to start seeing them, especially the Saudis, start to turn back the faucet a little bit to appease the other member nations and also to get them some more money coming in. The real wild card is this one here, and that's what's going to happen in Iran. Okay, I don't know. I think I'm in a... I know I'm among smart people. How in God's name did this negotiation take place? I don't get this. I wish they'd have sent my wife over to do this. My wife is the best negotiator that I know. As a matter of fact, we have this agreement. If we ever get a divorce, I at least get my BMW to sleep in. I mean, I said, we gave up everything and we're getting almost nothing that I see. It's just a terrible deal. But here's what Iran has said. In December, they're putting out for auction 45 properties to show to international exploration companies. And their goal is to bump their production from 3.1 to 5.7 million barrels of oil per day. Now, it'll take them some time to do that. First of all, they got to find companies that are crazy enough to go in and do that. There's always the French, right? Anyway, they got to find some people crazy enough going to do that and work with those people, but then it's going to take some time for this to happen. But this is kind of the wild card here that makes it kind of screw it. Now, the good news for us in the oil and gas industry is if you look at the futures market is in what we call contango. Contango is a situation where the spot price today is below the futures market. So people are spending millions of dollars on the price of oil. They're thinking the price of oil is going to go up. Right now this is August 28th. This number today is about 44. This is about 51. Somewhere like this is about a $7 difference. Okay? So they're expecting the price. The good news is not in what is called backwardation. Backwardation situation where you have the spot price here and the futures price is down here, and you're saying, oh, shoot, that would be really bad, or some variation of that. Anyway, so the futures market is saying, hey, the price is going to go up. And so here's what we're forecasting. We're forecasting that the price of oil is going to average $55 a barrel next year, go to 60 in 2017, around a modest range of $30 to $90 a barrel. I think it's a fairly modest range, don't you? But this is the hardest thing in the economy to forecast. Any stinking thing can happen, as we've learned in the last year. Now, I'm going to stop here. I have one more little thing to show you and see if you got any kind of quick questions. You okay? Y'all been good? You're all right? Well, let me finish up with this. Whenever you get kind of discouraged about the way things are going, I want you to kind of understand something about where you live. You live in a place in the United States where we have this amazing history of responding to energy crises. Now, you may have thought the first energy crisis occurred in the 1970s. That was not the first energy crisis. The first energy crisis in this country occurred at the time of the Civil War in 1865. In 1865, the major source of artificial light, this stuff here, was whale oil. And the supply-demand curve for whale oil was such that whale oil was selling for 23 cents a gallon. When the Civil War occurred, two things happened to disrupt the whale oil market. First, many of the ships used in whaling were conscripted into the Northern Navy, were subsequently captured by Southern privateers, or destroyed. The supply of whale oil dropped off dramatically. Secondly, anytime you have a war, there's a big increase in the demand for artificial light. As a result, the price of whale oil went from 23 cents a gallon in 1865 to $1.45 a gallon in 1867, a 600% increase in the price of whale oil in just 2 years. They did not set up a department of whales. They did not pass rules about so much whale oil in one lamp, that's all you can have. You know what they did? Absolutely nothing. They didn't have to. Because 6 years earlier, in 1859, somebody had literally hammered 61 feet of pipe into the ground in Titusville, Pennsylvania, and had hit crude oil. But the crude oil had just sat there. Because when whale oil was 23 cents a gallon, crude oil couldn't compete with it. But when the white price of whale oil went from 23 cents a gallon in 1865 to $1.45 a gallon in 1867, some smart, clever, greedy capitalist figured out a way to refine crude oil into kerosene. 1867, kerosene broke the whale oil market. Whale oil lamps became something your ancestors and mine looked for in antique stores. There was no department of whales, no rules about so much whale oil in any one lamp. There was just an abiding faith in the character, ingenuity, and the ability to adapt of American capitalists. Abiding faith in the character, ingenuity, and ability to adapt of folks just like you. Enjoyed being with you again this year. Thank you so much for the invitation to be here.